was that Joe had been, Joe was quite a seeker, and he'd been all over. He'd been at the ashrams and sat at the feet of the Dalai Lama and studied Eastern religion, Western religion, you name it. And then he came to Don and he said, will you sponsor me? And Don said, well, look, I'll sponsor you, but if I'm going to sponsor you, we're going to be coming out of the big book. So you're going to have to put all that other crap aside, and we're going to come out of the big book. And out of that, he always gave Don credit for writing the set-aside prayer, but Don said, I didn't write it. Joe wrote it based on that conversation. But it's a prayer that basically goes something like, God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself, alcoholism, AA, the big book, and even you, God. Help me to have an open mind so that I can have a new experience. Words to that effect. And I work with that a lot with my guys and with myself. I try to read 2 pages a day out of the big book. And I can't tell you how many times I've gotten up in the morning, done the set-aside prayer. This probably doesn't happen to you guys, but I tend to read the book and I'm not necessarily looking for new information. Especially if I've been reading a long time, I'm looking for ways that I'm already right. I got a bad habit of, reading. And so when, I don't know I'm missing stuff. You know, when we say, how do you know what you don't know? I mean, that'll give you a brain cramp if you think about it. But if I'm not careful, what I think I know can stand in the way of the truth. And it happens way into sobriety, you know, because what happens is I'm reading the book and I'm reading along and I go, oh, yeah, this is that part where it says that. Oh, yeah, I know this. Yeah, oh, there's that jaywalker, whatever. But I get to pieces and I go, oh, you can't tell me anything about this piece. You know, I've already got it highlighted and underlined, you know, in the book. And it's amazing how many times I'll do the set-aside prayer and a brand new piece of information will come up off the page. And so I like working with it because, I don't know, I mean, otherwise I'm just looking for, we call it a confirmation bias, where I'm just really kind of looking for confirmation of ways that I'm already right. And I'm not picking up a whole lot of new information that way. And a lot of things happen. When you start coming at somebody with something that differs from what their current belief system is, or God forbid you come at me with something that differs from what my beloved sponsor told me, the ego goes into self-defense mode, and now it's literally about the life and death of the ego. It's not about the little issue anymore. It's the ego fighting for its life. So that's why we use the path of consideration and spiritual consent and, you know, phrases like, is it possible that, or I'd like to offer you for your consideration that maybe, because if it's just ways to try to get information around the ego without it going into self-defense. Because, I mean, not right now. I talked about being a recovered alcoholic, you know, and I didn't hear that for a long time. And I don't usually say that in a regular talk because one of the things I worry about is alienating the exact guys. And, you know, it's one thing to preach to the choir, but I don't want to shut down the exact guys I'm talking to because I've been that guy. You know, I was the guy that was like, oh, he's one of those, you know, and I'm done. You know, I'm not trying to hear anything else. But if we're going to talk about recovery, I don't know. It's funny. I was talking to Bill one day, and I was saying, how the funny thing in AA is that when we form a firing squad, we always form a circle, you know. And so we wind up with some of our best members that are out there in the trenches slugging away, all about saving drunks, but we're fighting over recovering or sponsee protege or little things like that. But if we're going to talk about being recovered, because you could argue it both ways, but if we're going to talk about what are we talking about having recovered from, and in the forward, you know, there on that title page it said that in the forward of the first edition it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You know, They thought they had discovered something big enough that it was worth putting in book form, you know, so it didn't get all scattered out like that telephone game where you start a little saying off here, and by the time it gets to the back of the room, it's not anything like what we're talking about. You know, I do love that line where it says to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. They felt they found something. You know, what really made AA a big deal when it hit the ground was an understanding of three things. It was an understanding of the problem with alcoholism, a solution for that problem, and then a program of action that would bring about that solution. And the book is full of stories of where people had two out of three of those things, but it was those three things coming together. And I always compare it to, like, if we were to go out to the car after the meeting, and let's say I don't know anything about cars, and I go out there and I stick my key in the car and nothing happens. Well, now I'm stuck, right? I don't even know what the problem is, you know? And then, so I'm sitting there and I'm not going, and then let's say Bruce comes up and goes, oh, man, you left your headlights on. You know, your headlights have been on all night. You've run the battery down. That's what your problem is. You got a dead battery. I'm like, okay, now I understand the problem. The problem is I got a dead battery. Am I going anywhere? No, you know, because I don't know what to do about it, you know. And he goes, well, you got to get some juice in that battery, you know, because it turns the starter and the starter fires, you know. And I go, oh, okay, now I know the solution. I got to get some juice in that battery. Still stuck, you know. Bill comes up and goes, raise your hood. I got jumper cables in my car. I'm going to pull over here next to it. We're going to put black on black. We're going to put red on red. I'm going to rev the engine. When I give you the signal, turn the key. Now I got a program of action that'll bring about the solution to my problem. But if we're not careful, I think we can diminish the problem. And the book, you know, I think sometimes we have a tendency, we talk about qualifying the new guy, and I do like I don't think I need to stand guard at the door of the AA, you know, and make sure that we're not being infiltrated by filthy dope fiends or you know, I mean, the stuff like that. But, I mean, I do think it's important to find out if this guy's one of us, and if he's in the right room. And if he's not in the right room, try to find a fellowship that he's going to identify in as much as I identify in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you always hear people saying, well, it's really just one solution and that sort of thing. But if you carry it through to the 12th step, when that guy's been around a minute and somebody comes up to him and says, will you sponsor me? They're not going to have that identification that takes place. And I really believe what the book says about how important that, because when that identification takes place, I'm willing to take action that I don't even have to understand yet. And we'll get back to that. Maybe. But, so if we're talking about having recovered, what are we talking about having recovered from? It says we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And, you hear when I was talking about disregarding the problem, you know, I think sometimes we assume that when a guy gets in, my first job when I sit down with a new guy is to give him what I call a fatal dose of alcoholism. I think we tend to think, you know, nobody gets to AA by mistake, or I've heard there was a treatment center at home that would say, you work the first step getting here. Anybody heard that one? Yeah, well, it wasn't my experience, and it wasn't Dr. Bob's experience, and it wasn't Fred's experience, and it wasn't, there's a lot of examples in the book. Of, you know, and like with Dr. Bob, it said he'd been banging around Oxford for a couple of years, and it says that he suspected a spiritual remedy might help him with his problem. So he knew the solution, and he had a program of action, but he didn't understand the problem. It wasn't until, it says, when the broker explained alcoholism to him the way Silkworth explained it to him, he went after the spiritual remedy with a energy, I'm paraphrasing now, energy he'd never been able to put forward before, and he's sober never to drink again for the rest of his life. That's how important the explanation of the problem was to Bob. And we'll talk more about where they understood the problem and the solution but didn't have a program of action. But, you know, I think when it talks about being one of our members properly armed with the facts about himself, and, you know, some of the stuff we're going to talk about is stuff that really helps me in my own experience. Sometimes it helps in taking new guys through the work. Because, like I said, there was a time when I felt a little awkward about taking a brand new guy through the work after I'd been around for a while. I mean, there was a time when I call it slogan slinging, you know, where if you'd have come at me, I'd have been like, okay, put the plug in the jug. That's a good one. Yeah, you know, and do 90 meetings a night. Don't drink no matter what, you know, and take this book. Take this book and read, well, just read the whole damn thing. And there was, sometimes there was parts of me that kind of hoped the guy didn't really call back, you know, because I hoped he found some solution, but in my heart, I knew I didn't have it for him, you know, I hope all the stuff we're going to talk about today is redundant for everybody. But my experience was that when it talks about being an ex-problem drinker who has found our solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, what does it mean to be armed with the facts about myself? And I like to talk about what it means to be an alcoholic, because I spent a good deal of time sitting in AA meetings, raising my hand, saying, I'm Charlie Parker, and I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't know what it meant. So if we're talking about having recovered, what are we talking about having recovered from? And I always say that I only have two problems. As an alcoholic, I only have two struggles with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it, and the other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I really don't have any struggles with alcohol. just gives me trouble when I'm drinking it or when I'm not drinking it. You know, but the first piece of it is this physical piece of alcoholism. And the doctor's opinion talks a lot about it, that I have an abnormal reaction to drinking. You know, it says that it's on Roman numeral 28. It's funny. I was talking about primary purpose group, and we study the book. Now, we're not just studying the book to have a ready answer in a discussion meeting or something. We're trying to get clarity on the message that they laid out in the book. What are they talking about, and in what order? You know, why are they laying this? Why are we talking about Fred, and why are we talking about him now? You know, if they were able to put this whole solution we could sit down and write, you know, 200 pages on step one, you know, and they put the whole deal, you know, in the first 164 pages of the book, and the bulk of it really in the first 103 pages. If they were able to be that concise with it, what information did they find important to put forward, and in what order? You know, and that's what we're studying. We don't like read a page and talk about our experience with it. We talk about what were the founders trying to, what information were they trying to put forth in that page. And we were talking about the doctor's opinion, because we're back at the front of the book. It's funny, I mean, somebody said one time, they go, what are you going to do about your meeting? I mean, it's standing room only. You know, there were people around the walls, and I was like, oh, don't worry. When we get into to wives and to employer, you know, and then when we get back to the front, you know, the room starts filling up again. But we're back in the doctor's opinion. One of the things I never really thought about is I use the doctor's opinion a lot. I was talking to somebody else that was talking about, you know, really pounding the doctor's opinion this morning. And I had always given Dr. Silkworth credit for endorsing our book. You know, I mean, these drunks had written this book, and we need some street cred, or we need some really legitimate cred, you know, so they go to this doctor. And I'd always given them credit, but really, I never really thought about how much I use the doctor's opinion when I'm working with a new guy. And it kind of came to me the other day that, you know, they'd already written a book when they handed it to Silkworth. And he didn't just endorse our book. He added a great deal to it. I mean, there's a lot of really powerful information in the doctor's opinion. And one of the pages I work with a ton is Roman numeral 28, XXBIII. I use this page in every conversation with a new guy, or sometimes it's with, I was in Bermuda last week, and I met a guy that was at this Thanksgiving dinner, and I said, how long are you sober? And he goes, 13 months. And I said, where are you at in the step work? We're just talking, you know, and he goes, well, I'm still kind of on step four. And in my mind, I'm thinking, probably not. You know, because I'm about getting through this work pretty rapidly, and I spent 4 hours with the guy the next morning down by the water, and now he's on step four, but And you know, and my favorite thing to hear when you're working with a guy like that is to have a guy that's been around a while, because he had 6 years another time, and he goes, "I've never heard the stuff you're talking about." That's, to me, that's the best thing there is to hear, is to have a guy that, you know, go, "I've been in and out of the area for X number of time, and I've never heard any of this stuff," you know. And so a lot of times I'll recap, even if it's a guy that's been around for a while, we'll recap these first steps. And and sometimes I'll say, "Well, teach it to me, you know. If, why don't you tell me what step one means? What does it mean to be an alcoholic?" You know, because one guy was ready to do his third step and write inventory, and I said, "Tell me about step one. What does it mean?" He goes, "That I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life." You know, he's proud of himself, you know. And I said, "Well, what does that mean to you?" And he's like, "It means that I can't go through one day without drinking." I said, "Okay, so if I can go through a day without drinking, I'm not alcoholic?" And he's like, "Oh, darn it." You know, so we had to have a conversation about what it means to be an alcoholic. In Silkworth, it was a big deal because, you know, it doesn't take too many times to tell my dad I'll never do this again and show him back up and do it again, you know, for me to think that there's something wrong with me. You know, when I showed up here, I'm thinking, disease my ass, there is something bad wrong with me, you know, and because I keep saying I'm not going to do it anymore, and I do. So for a long time, they thought it was a moral issue or an issue of control and that sort of thing. So but when we talk about what it means to be an alcoholic, one of the big things that Silkworth brought to the table was right here on Roman numeral 28. He says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago," he had written a paper about 4 years earlier putting these points forward. He says that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. I like to break these pages down when I'm talking to guys and stuff. And it says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. I am so capable of reading a line like that and just have it go, whoosh. You know, and breaking it down, it says that we believe that the action of alcohol on who? On these chronic alcoholics. Right? We're not talking about candy-ass little disco drunks here. You know, I mean, you know, what we call two beers and oh dear. You know, I mean, you know, it's a, you know, yeah, we're talking about chronic alcoholics, guys that have been running it for a while. And it says that the action of these guys is the manifestation of an allergy. Well, you know, allergy was a new term in the early 1900s. But for our purposes, we're just going to say that it means an abnormal physical reaction. Something happens to me when I drink that ain't regular. It doesn't happen to my sister. My sister's not alcoholic. And, I mean, when she drinks, it doesn't trigger this allergy with her. So if all we're going to say an allergy means is an abnormal physical reaction, right? Let's say I had an abnormal, and it says the manifestation of an allergy. All manifestation means is the way something shows up, the way something presents itself. And let's say this whole front row here was just over at breakfast, and they had a big basket of strawberries, and we all sat there and ate strawberries, except we come over here and I start going, you know, and all of a sudden my throat starts kind of swelling shut and my eyes are swelling shut, you know, and everybody else is fine, but I got an abnormal physical reaction to strawberries. And the way it manifests is in that swelling shut. And, you know, well, how does my allergy to alcohol manifest? What happens when I drink alcohol? And it calls it this phenomenon of craving. Well, phenomenon just means something that we know happens, but we don't really know why it happens. We've seen it happen enough to know that it happens, but we don't really know why it happens. And what is this? What happens when I drink? It calls it craving. It says, when I drink, for me, it triggers a craving that is beyond my control. Right? When I start drinking, it triggers a craving for more booze. So when I take the first drink, it triggers a craving for the second drink. This is the physical piece of alcoholism. And by the time I get to the fifth drink, it sounds like a better idea than the second one did. You know, and I don't really need to read this book, or it doesn't matter what Charlie says. the most important thing you can do with any of the stuff in this book, I mean, that a new guy can do with any of this stuff, is lay it up against your own experience and see if it's a fit. See what happens when I drink. Does it? Because, but the thing is, the disease is tricky. You know, my mind never tells me, you know, I don't ever remember walking into a Spillway pub there in East Dallas and going, oh, Bobby, God Almighty. Spiritual malady is on me today. You know? And I had a beer on the way over here, and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving that is kicking my ass. You know, I mean, you know, and the thing about it is I never thought I'd triggered the phenomenon of craving. I just thought I changed my mind. Right? You know where you go, the guys at work go, hey, we're going to go have a couple of drinks after work at the pool hall, you know, and I'm like, would you like to go? And I'm like, yes, I would. And then I get over there and they go, hey, listen, dude, I got to bounce. The old lady's making spaghetti at the house. And I'm the guy that's going, spaghetti, really? No, rock on, dude. I changed my mind. I'm going to stay here, you know. And I never thought I'd triggered this craving. But if I told you that I was going in to have a couple of drinks, and I get in there, and it turns out 2 was a bad number, you know. I should have guessed higher, you know. And next thing you know, I'm off on a run. And the book, in the doctor's opinion, in the first 23 pages of the book, does an awful lot talking about this physical allergy to alcohol. And I've even got one of my sponsees made a little graphic about it that is part of that stuff that I sent out. He even put the two little fists in there. I swear, I see guys on the street in Austin that I've met at the treatment center. They're like, Charlie, what's up? You know, I mean, but when we talk about what happens when I drink is the first piece. And it says that it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. And it goes on to say, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And I have to ask myself, one of the things in my crew is we're big on turning statements into questions out of the big book. We're taking statements that are in the big book and turning them into questions and asking myself, is this my condition? Is this true for me? Do I find myself with these beliefs based on my experience? Is this true for me? And I have to ask myself, are these true? That once having formed the habit and I'm found I cannot break it, once having lost my self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, my problems pile up on me and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Damn. Nobody shows up for AA on a winning streak. You know, I mean, that thing about problems piling up and becoming astonishingly difficult to solve. God Almighty. But this thing about, well, it says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. You know, you can't just come at me with, you know, some... That identification that takes place when one drunk is talking to another, one of the best ways to illustrate how important it is when it's not there. I showed up for treatment on December 8th of 83. And I'm a big boy now, but I was about 25 pounds heavier then. And I say that because I was really interested in Christmas dinner. You know, it was Christmas Day, and they had put the whole deal out. It was, you know, turkey and dressing and mashed potatoes and cranberry sauce and giblet gravy and rolls and and I'm just sitting down with my big old Jethro plate, and right as I'm sitting down, the door swings open, and in walks 5 people from one of the local churches. There's some do-gooders from one of the local churches, and they've come to sing Christmas carols to us heathen alcoholics, right? You can imagine my excitement, right? Because now I don't get to eat, and they're going to sing. And this one woman, though, I watch her, and she's walking along, and she leans over, and she says something to this guy, and then she says something to this guy, and then she says something to this lady. And when she gets to me, she says, are you a patient here? And I said, yes, I am. She said, I know exactly what you're going through. I said, really? And she said, yes. I was once addicted to caffeine. Well, I was like, ain't that a bitch? You know? I'm like, I'm like, let me ask you a question. Did you ever pawn your mom's sterling silver to get a can of Folgers? You know, I mean, bless your heart. That's what people do. They're trying to identify, but it ain't there. You know. Well, that's that depth and weight we're talking about. And it says in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. Well, I want to get rolling so we can get through step one. But down here at the bottom of that page, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I mean, I like banana pudding, but I love the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't just burn my world to the ground over something I kind of dig a little bit. You know, I mean, it was. But it says the sensation is so elusive that while I admit it's harmful, while I admit it's injurious, after a while, I can't differentiate the truth from the false. And one of the ways I can't differentiate the truth from the false is, and I love the way Clancy says, if you gave every one of us a flag to wave when we get here, everybody's flag would say the same thing. It would say, you don't understand, my case is different. You don't understand, my case is different. Because my, you know, the feeling I show up here with is, if look, I understand you got your little 12-step thing here, but if you understood how complicated and complex a person I am and my background, and you know, you'd really be a little embarrassed to be offering me your little hinky 12-step thing, you know. And so it goes on to say, and one of the ways I can't tell the truth from the false is I think I'm fixing to get a handle on it. I'm the guy sitting in a treatment center thinking, I ain't like these other guys. You know, if I ever get as lame as these guys, maybe I'll do your little deal, but I just need to rest up a minute. I know I was in a bad spot. I know it looks bad that I'm sitting in this county-funded detox center. But you know, I was just, but when I get out of here, I'm going to manage this thing a little better, and I ain't like these guys, and I don't have to do what they do because I ain't like that. You know, when I get out of here, I'm going to manage this thing a little better. I'm not going to drink tequila anymore. I'm not going to drink with those guys. I'm probably going to start studying the Bible or something, you know. I mean, but I ain't like this, and I don't have to do that. And that happens in pretty short order. Dr. Harry Tebow wrote some papers about us where he said the recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego are astounding. You know, and this is a non-alcoholic watching us because, you know, on day one, I'm like, oh, please help me. I'll do anything, you know. And after a couple of weeks, I start going, I don't really like this place, you know. I don't like my counselor. I don't like the program here. Have you seen that Nimrod they gave me for a roommate? You know, I mean, and the food, for God's sakes, you know, and this is 10 days after I'll do anything, you know. I mean, and it happens over and over and over again. And it says, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I love that. I mean, because, you know, I always say, if I went to my sainted 90-year-old mother and said, Mom, I can't come over today. I got to go see my PO and give a UA because I got a DUI. She would have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, around here we're like, oh man, dude, who's your PO? You know, how much time you got? I can tell you how to beat a UA. And my alcoholic life seems the only normal because of the time, you know, my mother, I told you she was a first grade school teacher. She had a way of moving just this one finger when she would talk to you, you know, and I can remember her going, and it would always start off with, you are such an idiot. You drink every day. And I'm sitting there, I'm untouched by that because I'm thinking, everybody I know drinks every day, you know? I don't hang with somebody that doesn't drink every day. And what I didn't know to tell her is that if drinking did for you what it does for me, you'd be stupid not to drink every day, you know? Why wouldn't I drink every day? It's the greatest thing I ever, you know. Well, it goes on to say, here's where it gets ugly. It says, if you go to page 23... there's a little piece where it says, I've written in that little space under the first line, I've written, looking at the body stops here. Because on the page before, it says we're equally positive that once he takes alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. You know, and in the doctor's opinion, he describes five types of alcoholics. And it doesn't matter, there's a squillion types of us. But it says all these and many other types have one thing in common. They can't start drinking without triggering this phenomenon of craving, this thing that happens when I start drinking. It's a big problem. But over on page 23, it says these observations, what observations? All these observations they've been making about what happens to me when I drink. It says these observations would be academic and pointless. I always say that means, that translates to wouldn't mean squat. No, I'm sorry, number 23. Page 23, when there is a solution. And see, up to the doctor's opinion in the first 23 pages talks about this physical reaction to alcohol. And right here on page 23, it shifts, and it's not talking about the body anymore. And it says these observations, this is top of page 23, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting a terrible cycle in motion. You know, it's a big problem what happens to me when I drink vodka. It triggers this craving. It sends me on a run that I got really no control over. But if my biggest problem was what happens when I drink 4 ounces of vodka, what would my solution be? Don't drink vodka, you know? I'd be like the guy that, you know, says, Doc, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor says, well, don't do that, you know? I mean, but just think of what a crappy, is it Mike? Tom, imagine what a crappy program this would be if we bring Tom in here, you know, and we go, okay, Tom, you got a physical reaction to alcohol that ain't regular. When you drink, it's going to trigger a run that, you know, in the long run, it's going to get away from you. And it's really going to get ugly. And over the long run, it's just going to get worse and worse. Quit it. Just quit it, you know. Well, then, but it goes into this thing, and this is where the second piece of alcoholism comes in, is what happens when I don't drink. Because I never thought about this for a long time. Every time I ever took that first drink, the drink that triggers another run, or a spree, as the big book calls it, every time I ever took that first drink, I was stone cold sober. Right? I can't blame the first drink on being loaded. I make that decision stone cold sober. The craziest, you know, it's funny. I had my guys one time, we all sat down and wrote down, what's the most insane things you've ever done? Give me a list of about 4 or 5 things. Makes for a hell of a discussion, but but none of us put down the single most insane thing any of us have ever done. And the most, based on my experience and my background, the most insane thing that I can do is take another run at it. You know, is go, I think I'm going to try shooting dope one more time, or I'm going to try drinking one more time. I think I can handle it this time, you know. And I make that decision stone cold sober. That's where the second, this is what happens to me when I'm not drinking. And going back to that Roman numeral 28 in the doctor's opinion, he talks about it. He says, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. Now, this is sober. This is when I'm not drinking. I get a little restless, you know. I get a little jumpy. I don't like the way my clothes are touching me. You know, if I'm inside sitting down, it feels like I ought to be outside walking around. And I'm like a dog that can't find its spot. You know, I'm circling around, but I don't feel right, and I get a little restless. And then irritable, God Almighty. After a couple of weeks, couple of days, whatever it is, I start getting a little irritable, you know. And I mean, I never really liked the idea of being irritable. It's funny, I was talking to a sponsor the other day. He goes, I came home from work today. He goes, I was kind of irritated, just supervisor at work. And then I was irritated at Heather when I got, and the guy in traffic irritated me. And you know, this is condensed in the conversation. But I said, you know, it's funny, I hear you talking a lot about being irritated, you know, today. And he goes, yeah. And I go, but you probably wouldn't like being described as irritable. And he goes, no, I wouldn't. You know, I mean, you know, it's like, I never thought I was irritable. But it's not my fault if I just become keenly aware of how stupid everybody else is, you know? I mean, that's just being observant, you know? You know, I mean, you know, and before I know it, you know, the guy at work is a dumbass, and my boss is a dumbass, and this guy in front of me in traffic is a moron, and the guy behind my ass is a maniac, and you know, I think that guy just gave me a look, you know, and before long, I'm just a little irritable, you know, and I always say that, you know, I'm in the grocery store. I'm following somebody 3 miles past the exit to my house so I can tell them they're number one, and then, you know, I'm the policeman of the world. You know, it's my job to throw a flag on the field anytime I see a violation anywhere. You know, and if I see position of neutrality is not even part of my, you know, the guy in front of me at the grocery store has got 14 items on the 10-item lane. And the reason I know is because I counted every you know, and on the wrong day, I'm the guy that's going, okay, pal, which four of those items you want to put back, you know? And if he comes back with the wrong answer, it's a bad day at the grocery store, you know? And next thing you know, I'm calling the family from jail, you know, and I'm going, how do I get arrested buying milk? You know, I mean, I was trying to do the right thing. I just went to the grocery store to get milk for the kids. But, you know, somebody's got to say something, you know, to this guy. You know, somebody's got to draw a line in the sand. And if not me, who? You know, and that's the way it's, you know, and then I get a little discontented, you know, discontented. Means I don't like the deal I'm getting. You can give one of us a $150,000 a year job, and inside of 6 months, I'll tell you how I'm getting screwed around. You know? I mean, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm sure. From where you're sitting, it looks like I'm making a lot of money, but you should see how much money they're making off of me, you know? And this Nimrod in the next cubicle makes $30,000 a year more than I do, and I'm doing my job and half of his, you know? And before long, you know, I'm the key employee. I'm the one that the whole company is hinged on. And next thing you know, they're marching the key employee out to the curb, you know, scratching that unemployed ass, and, you know, and I'm going, how can you be firing me? You know, this place will crater without me, you know, but I just, you know, I'm discontented. You know, I don't like the way the kids are treating me. I don't like the way my wife's treating me. You know, somebody could say good morning, and I'm like, oh, are you jacking with me already? You know, and before long, I get this, I need some relief, you know, when I've been sober a little while. I need some relief. And the book, the doctor's opinion, he says, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort. That feeling that comes at once from taking a few drinks. And it says, drinks that I see others taking with impunity. You know what impunity means? It means they don't get punished for it. They get to have a couple of drinks, and it doesn't cost them their job and their car and their old lady and their house and all the values they grew up with and you know, in their self-respect and their dignity. They just get to have a couple of drinks. And when I need relief, I start wanting to know, where's mine? Where's mine? How come this Nimrod gets to have a couple of pops after work and I don't? You know, and eventually, on, you know, when I need relief bad enough, on page 24, it talks about it again. It says, a lot starts happening in 23, 24, 25, 26. It says that I've lost the power of choice in drink. My willpower becomes practically non-existent, and I am unable at certain times to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And that doesn't matter whether it's my suffering and humiliation or my family's suffering and humiliation. When I need relief, I can't think about it. That's why it always kills me when we have a... They go, we got a new guy. Let's have a step one meeting today. And what does everybody talk about? Instead of pulling this guy with the message of the hope of recovery through this process, everybody talks about all the bad stuff that happened to them when they're drinking. You know, I went to prison 22 times, and I started drinking as an embryo, and DWIs. Like we're going to scare this new guy into getting sober. When on page 24, it tells me that my own stuff won't scare me bad enough to keep me sober. You know, it's not like I'm going to be, when that's on me, it's not like I'm going to be in the liquor store and going, oh, remember what happened to that guy at the meeting? I don't want any of that. You know, I'm telling myself it ain't going to, or I may not even, by the time I take that first drink, it seems like common sense. It seems like the next logical action is to take a drink because I get so uncomfortable, you know. And anyway, it goes on to say, once this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid. The thing about it is, when I'm working with a new guy, my first job is to give him a fatal dose of alcoholism, what I call a step one experience. And being able to break this stuff down, I can't tell you how many times I've seen guys, you know, the guy that's in treatment for the 15th time, and they'll lean forward in their chair just like I did and go, hold on just a minute. This stuff you're saying, I've never heard it before. And it explains a lot of stuff that I've never been able to explain. You know, there's one question that I ask a lot of guys, and, you know, whenever we would promise people we're never going to drink again, and mean it, my family, my people, my work, whatever it is, and I'd swear to God, this is it. And then they'd see us drinking again. They'd always ask that question. They'd go, why did you start drinking again? And I'd give them the only answer we got, which is what? I swear to God, it's like a chorus throughout our fellowship. I don't know. I don't know. God Almighty, I don't know. You know, it's just what I do. You know, I drink, I guess, and I hurt people's feelings, and I that's what I'm talking about. When I show up here, I thought there was something wrong with me. And when you see that guy all of a sudden go, the stuff you're saying explains a lot of stuff I've never been able to explain. It explains why whenever I start drinking, it always gets away from me. And it explains why when I stop, and by God, this time I mean it. You know, this time I'm serious. I'm never going to that I always drink again. You know, I always say Alcoholics Anonymous is not for a guy that can make up his mind to stop drinking and pull it off. A guy that can make up his mind to stop drinking doesn't even belong in AA. I mean, they're welcome to come. They can drink the coffee, and they kind of wish they'd keep their mouth shut and not sponsor anybody. But sorry, that was a personal opinion. Because, I mean, the guy's welcome in AA, but, you know, you let a drunk like me roll in, you know, a year later, and what works for that guy might kill a drunk like me. Because he doesn't have to have a complete psychic change or a spiritual experience. He can just put the plug in the jug. And I don't like to spend a lot of time figuring out whether somebody's a real alcoholic or a hard drinker or that sort of thing. But the book talks about it a little bit. And really, most of this stuff, I think the most important thing is to ask myself, what are my current beliefs on this stuff? And are they based on, do they match with what the book is saying? The stuff they're saying in the book, where did I get this belief? And is it consistent with the big book? Well, there is something that happens when all of a sudden I go, what if I'm just a garden variety alcoholic? What if, and I know I got all these complications and I got things that have happened to me and things that haven't happened to me and that sort of thing. But what if throughout the middle of that, I'm just a garden variety alcoholic and I have a body that can't drink regular and I got a mind that, you know, there is something that happens. There is a surrender that takes place in that first step experience. And tied to that surrender is a willingness to go through the rest of the work that's not there when my step one is just an academic statement. When I'm going, yeah, I'm alcoholic, or, you know, whatever that means. I mean, there is something that happens when I break down in my heart that I got this thing. And on my own power, I ain't fixing it. You know, on my own, you know, I'm sitting there going, if I got it the way you're describing it, I got no shot. I got no shot. It's like getting in the boxing ring with Mike Tyson. You know, I couldn't beat him with a pocket knife. You know, for me to try to stop alcoholism with willpower is like trying to stop a freight train with a volleyball net. It's just woefully inadequate. You know, but the thing about that first step experience is it drives the rest of my process through the work. You know, we read in that. That piece of the book that we read before every meeting, you know, How It Works. I call it the most often read, least listened to portion of the big book. That's as close as I came to meditation for a while was, you know, I would go, you know, they go, rarely have we seen a person fail, and boom, I'm out of the room, you know, and then come back in about the time they go, be that God could and would if, or see that God could and would if he saw it. But in that thing, it reads, they say, we stood at the turning point. We being, you know, most of the time, this is an interesting thing, we talk about we. Who is the we that they're talking about throughout the book? And it's describing the founders of our program, the people that founded it, who had had this experience and who found it important enough to put it in book form, or people that have experienced the recovery program and had the complete psychic change is the we we're talking about. You know, it says it in the foreword of the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But it always cracks me up. We'll definitely talk about the chanting in AA at some point, but it just cracks me, you know, when they read the ninth step promises, you know, and they go, are these extravagant promises? And you got the guys going, we think not. And I'm like, really? Really? Those are not extra. I guess you can just be alone at perfect peace and ease, you know, fear of economic insecurity is just gone. You know, I mean, intuitively know how to handle situations. Damn right those are extravagant promises. You know, on the other side of it, now it says we think not, the people that have had the psychic change. But when I'm sitting there, you know, I think when I plop down $10 on a big book, I become part of we, you know, and I'm saying, we think not. And in the meantime, my brain is going, bing, 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 you know. But the thing about this whole step one experience, it's a very powerful piece of the recovery process. But there's no good news in step one. There's no happy ending to step one. I mean, you know, if I explain step one to a guy and he's not a little scared and depressed, either he's not alcoholic, or I haven't done a very good job of describing it, or he's psychotic. Because, I mean, that would be the short version. Imagine if we bring a guy in and we go, okay, Bruce, here's the deal. You got a body that ain't regular. When you drink, it's going to trigger this physical reaction to go off on another run. It's a craving that's way bigger than you are. And over any period of time, it's going to get away from you. You're going to drink a lot more than you can successfully handle. It's a big problem. Not your biggest problem, though. You also got a mind that's going to get so uncomfortable that it's going to convince you to drink again every time. Every time, every time. Really sorry. Try to have a nice day. but that's all we'd have if we just had step one, you know. But the first 7 pages of working with others does a really good job of describing the first visit with a guy. And this is a lot of it, where it says, we get talking about drinking. He talks about his drinking. I talk about my drinking. If he's light, I go with jokes. If he's heavy, I talk about serious stuff. But it tells me how to approach this guy. And it says at some point in the conversation, we turn the discussion to alcoholism, and he says, we suggest you do it as we've done it in the chapters on alcoholism. And that's this stuff we're talking about. And we start talking about that it's not just that I like to party. It's I got a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession that adds up to a terrible cycle. You know, when it says on that page 23, it says these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. And that's what this graphic is of the terrible cycle. When I'm trapped in that, I'm going to drink at some point, and I'm going to trigger this phenomenon of craving, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to drink. But after I drink for a while, things get really bad, and I have to stop. And now I've stopped, and I'm okay. You know, things are going pretty good. I got a little folding money in my pocket. I'm back in the big bed. You know, things are, you know, I may not lose the job. But you know what happens after I don't drink for a while? things get really bad. So eventually I have to drink. So this terrible cycle is I drink until I have to stop, and then I stop until I have to drink. And that's the terrible cycle. That's the seemingly hopeless state of mind. But I always say, if you're stuck in that, there's a bottom below the bottom you know. Whatever, you know, seems crappy this year, the guy might look back in 3 years and go, I wish I'd quit in 2013 when things were still going pretty good, you know. I mean, I always tell guys, don't ever say it can't get any worse. You know? All that shows is a lack of imagination, you know. But the reason is, but it's interesting that if the book has our whole recovery program laid out in that much of the book, essentially the first 103 pages of the book, it spends that much of it, the doctor's opinion in the first 44 pages, talking about the problem. And then it spends, you know, the next 60 pages talking about the solution. But I mean, they spend almost half the text talking about the problem. It's so important that I get that step one experience, because what happens is I actually just circled back around to one. I drifted away from how it works and I just came back to it. You know, in how it works, we read, we stood at the turning point. The "we" got me thrown off there for a minute. It says, we stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Do you ever ask yourself, what is that turning point? And it describes it at the bottom of page 25. It says, if you were as alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. See if these are statements, turn these statements into questions. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if I'd passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, I can't stop me, my sponsor can't stop me, my brother, my mother, my probation officer, my best friend, nobody is going to keep me sober on human power. It says we had but two alternatives. This is the turning point, right? It says one was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. And the other was to accept spiritual help. That's it. We talk about that all the time. Does it really come down, and do you still believe at 28 years sober, Charlie, that your two choices are die an alcoholic death, live life on a spiritual basis? You know, go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation, or accept spiritual help. And the reason I love drunks is we're the only group of people that, given those two choices, we go, damn. Yeah. Can you tell me a little more about that bitter end? You know, I mean, how bitter is it? And because I sense that I get to drink on my way to the bitter end, you know. And the reason you got to hammer this step one with me is because for a drunk like me, when drinking does for you what it did for me, you got to cut off every loophole, every possible avenue of escape, every little claw, every bit ounce of wiggle room for me to be trapped in a hopeless state of mind and body. And then it says over on page, I think it's on 26. 27. Oh, my God. I love that certain American businessman, you know. Roland Hazard had gone to Carl Jung, and, well, this is when we're going to start switching into 22, but it's talking about spirit, you know, that we might think we can do without spiritual help. This Roland Hazard story is fantastic. I mean, he was the guy that had enough money to burn a wet elephant. And I mean, he was an investment banker. And I was married to an investment banker. I know how the woman with the place in the Hamptons. This guy, when he realized he had a drinking problem, he went to see Carl Jung. I say it'd be like going to see, you know, Dr. Phil or Deepak Chopra now or something. I got a problem. I'm going to the big guy, you know. And he gets on a boat and goes to Switzerland. He spends 45 days with him, and he learns you know, a lot about the inner springs of his mind and that sort of thing. And see if this sounds like one of us getting out of treatment. He says, though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he'd acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. You know, the story is that guy didn't even make it back to the boat. You know, they found him, the way I understand it, they found him on a train in Spain, you know, drunk off his ass. And they bring him back to Carl Jung, and he's asking about it. And Carl Jung says, he was utterly hopeless. This is an awful doctor's visit. You know, he says, he'd have to be locked up or have a bodyguard. And he goes, you know, he goes on to say, some of our readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation. The doctor says, you got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. That's what we've just been talking about. You know, the difference between a moderate drinker, hard drinker, real alcoholic. And he goes, check this out for a doctor's visit. He says, I've never seen one single case recover. And he says what any good drunk would say. He goes, is there no exception? You know? Come on, man. This is old Charlie here. You know? I mean, you know. Is there? And the doctor says, he goes, well, here and there, once in a while, we've seen people have these spiritual experiences. You know, this is rolling into step two now. But he, you know, he says, to me, they're phenomenon. He goes, they appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So Carl Jung understood the problem. He told the guy he's a chronic alcoholic, and he even knew what the solution was. He says, there are these vital, but he didn't know how to make it happen. I've been organizing an AA golf tournament in Austin for 27 years. We used to have the Legends of Golf. The whole seniors tour was born in Austin. And so I came up with the Legends of Sobriety, and it was really clever when we had the Legends of Golf, but it's been gone for 15 years, so it's just a stupid name for a golf tournament now. But one day we're having the tournament, and the marshal comes up. And, you know, he's the guy that is in a little cart. He's supposed to keep everybody moving and make sure you're not driving on the greens and, you know, that sort of thing. And the marshal comes up. We're all kind of waiting at this one hole. And he knows that we're an AA golf tournament. And I'll never forget it. He comes up, and he goes, so you guys are AA? And I said, yeah. And we started talking. He goes, my dad was a drunk. He goes, my dad was the angriest, most awful man you'd ever want to be around. He was a racist. He was a bigot. He was just mad at everybody and drank every day of his life. And, you know, and just, and he goes, and then he's in his 60s. He's in his late 60s, and he got really, really sick. And the whole family went down. He went into a coma. And he said the whole family went down to the hospital, and we were around his bed. And he's laying in the bed. He's completely unconscious. And he says, all of a sudden, both his hands went up in the air like this. And he's holding his hands up in the air, and he starts talking to people that we can't see. And he's talking about world hunger and ending world hunger. He's talking about world peace and stuff like that. And then he goes, I have to leave you now, but a better man is coming to take my place. Whoa, both his hands just dropped down to the bed, and they thought he was dead. He wasn't dead. He comes out of the coma, and for the rest of his life, he never takes another drink of alcohol. The racism's gone. The bigotry's gone. The anger's gone. Sweetest guy you could ever hope to be around. Keeps a bottle of whiskey under the kitchen sink in case company comes over. Never touches a drop of it for the rest of his life. Complete psychic change. Vital spiritual experience. But imagine the powerlessness that Dr. Jung was feeling when he's talking to Roland Hazard saying, we got to get you one of those. You know? I got no idea how to make it happen. But that's what makes AA a big deal, is that we understand the problem, we know what the solution is, and we have a program of action that'll bring about the solution every time. You know, in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening. The only shot that a drunk like me has got is the spiritual awakening. The book describes it as a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, a personality change sufficient to overcome drinking, a change of heart. Whatever it is, something big has got to happen for a drunk like me to stop getting loaded for a month, much less, you know, 28 years or permanently. And we have a program of action that says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So it's telling me that the result, my only shot is the result of these steps will bring about the only thing that'll help a drunk like me. And the thing that amazes me is now, you know, so many people out there, I was talking at breakfast with some guys, so many people come into a 12-step program now, and we don't work the 12 steps. You know, for a whole bunch of us, this AA thing is going to those meetings and not drinking. And that works really good. If you're a drunk like me, going to meetings and not works right up to the point that I either drink or blow my brains out. You know, so I really was saying at breakfast, I really believe, and I wouldn't put this in the grapevine or anything, but I think people in our fellowship that have worked all 12 steps are in the minority. I think there's a whole bunch of us that haven't. So I like talking about it. But I mean, if I had this terminal cancer that's untreatable, and they go, is there no exception? They said, well, there's a study they're doing up in Seattle where they're having about a 90% success rate, but we don't really know what they're doing. You know, I mean, you wouldn't be able to keep me out of Seattle. You know, I mean, I'd be selling my house to move to Seattle. But I come in here and I go, I think I'll just work on me for a minute, or you know that sort of thing. So I like to talk about the importance of this step one, but it drives me in. You know, I don't generally. The chapter we agnostics, I'm really talking about one and two here, and we're almost done. The thing about one and two, now the chapter we agnostics is one of the most powerful pieces of spiritual literature out there. I mean, there is some real depth to that chapter. But it talks an awful lot about laying aside prejudice and looking at my old ideas and asking myself, where did they come from? And, you know, I don't generally spend a tremendous amount of time in step two with a new guy, because I love that line on page 27, because after Carl Jung has, or 28, it says, here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with the desperation of a drowning man. That step one experience tied to that desperation is a willingness that drives me through the rest of the work. You know, if I'm down to die an alcoholic death, live life on a spiritual basis, this solution gets really interesting. I don't know why I'd be interested in a power greater than myself when I still think my power will get the job done. But the moment that I understand in my core that on my own shot, I got no chance, on my own power, I got no shot, then this power gets real interesting. You know, then I start talking about, you know, when it says we in our turn sought the same escape with the desperation of a drowning man, the thing I love about drowning men is they don't ask a lot of questions, you know? Yeah. It's like you pull up and I'm drowning, I'm not going to go, tell me about your experience with working with drowning men. You know, I used to think it was really important that I knew what we were going to do, how it's going to go, what it's going to feel like while we're doing it, and what the end result is going to be. And I thought it was really important that I approve of the whole process. When I got that desperation of a drowning man, all you're going to hear out of me is, what do you want me to do? And the next thing you're going to hear is, okay, I did that. Now what do you want me to do? That's when we get this deal going. But we're not going anywhere until I really am driven by this flamethrower at my ass of, you know, Bill used to say we got two ultimate authorities in AA. We got, my mother goes to church just for spiritual thirst. We have two driving factors. One is God saying, come close to me and I'll take care of you. But we also got whiskey saying, if you screw around with this bill too much, I'll kill you. You know, so it's like not all of my spiritual endeavor is just out of thirst for being a better guy. There's some survivalist stuff in there, you know, and that's driven by this step one experience. Do I believe this is my only shot? Well, we're going to roll into step three after the break. But I can't tell you the power of being able to break this stuff down. I mean, you know, being able to sit down with a new guy and being properly armed with the facts about myself, you can set the hook. This is where we set the hook in that first visit. And then it talks about, suppose now you're making your second visit to this guy. He's read this book. He says he's ready to go through with the program of recovery. That's where we find ourselves on a second. And then we let him have it, you know. So let's take about a 15-minute break and get back in here, guys. Thanks.